This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Get up to 30% off well-crafted and personalized gifts from participating shops until May 12th. This year, embrace your creative side. You know, the side your mom gave you. And shop Etsy for custom jewelry, style pieces, home decor, and extra special items she'll adore. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
This is Intelligence Matters with former acting director of the CIA, Michael Morell. Brought to you by Lockheed Martin. Your mission is ours.
You know, there's no question that crypto has become the mechanism of choice for ransomware. They find that, when they use Bitcoin, it all travels on a public ledger. It's very traceable. It's immutable. And effectively, because it's a public ledger, it's actually giving law enforcement an incredible tool to actually find them, identify them, disrupt them, seize their crypto. Crypto actually gives you, and blockchain analytic tools give you the opportunity to detect and disrupt national security threats in a way that I think is very, very important. There's all kinds of really sophisticated and fascinating ways that you can use those technologies to counter corruption because of the nature of the technology. We need to have a national strategy to incentivize that financial technology out of the United States. It should be something that's really driven in the White House with the National Security Council and the National Economic Council. And I know there are lots of people, you know, who are really thinking about this problem.
Sigal Mendelker is an expert in finance and national security. From 2017 to 2019, she served as the Undersecretary of the Treasury for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence. During her career, she also served in the Department of Justice, the Department of Homeland Security, and as law clerks to two federal judges, including U.S. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. Now in the private sector at Ribbit Capital, Sigal is involved in helping to bring innovation to the financial industry. I just sat down with Sigal to talk about her career and the important links between finance and national security. We'll be right back with that discussion after a word from our sponsor, Lockheed Martin. I'm Michael Morell, and this is Intelligence Matters.
Have you ever covered a carpet stain with a rug, ignored a leaky faucet, pretended your half-painted living room is supposed to look like that? Well, you're not alone. We've all got unfinished home projects, but there's an easier way. When you download Thumbtack, it's easier to care for your home from top to bottom. Pull out your phone and in just a few steps, you can search, chat, and book highly rated pros right in your neighborhood. Plus, you'll know what to tackle next because Thumbtack is the app that shows you what to do, who to hire, and when. So say goodbye to all those unfinished home projects and say hello to caring for your home the easier way. Download Thumbtack and start a project today.
Sigal, welcome to Intelligence Matters. It's very nice to have you with us.
Thank you. It's really terrific to be here.
So, Sigal, we're going to discuss a little later in the episode the responsibilities you had in your most recent job in government at the Treasury Department. But one of those responsibilities included financial sanctions, imposing them, monitoring them, you know, a lot of different things with regard to them. And I know you have a story about the first sanctions that were ever imposed on another country by the United States. And it's a story that intersects with your life story. And I'd love if you could share that with us.
Yeah, thank you so much. I think it's a really remarkable story. And it's actually one that I learned several months into my time at Treasury because we had an incredible speaker come in, who's a historian at the Holocaust Museum named Rebecca Erbelding, who wrote a great book called Rescue Board. Anyway, it basically, sanctions as we know them today really started on April 9, 1940, when Henry Morgenthau, who was then the Secretary of the Treasury, was looking at the morning paper or the morning cables, and he sees that Hitler has invaded Denmark and Norway. He has no executive authority really to do so, but he picks up the phone and he calls the head of the New York Fed and he says, you know, all of those assets that you're holding for Denmark and Norway, I want you to freeze them, just freeze them. And the head of the New York Fed does it. And of course, the reason he wanted to freeze them was to keep Hitler from getting access to those funds. The very next day, Roosevelt signs the first executive order, really authorizing, right, what we know today as sanctions. And in fact, during the course of the war, every time Hitler invaded a country, they did the same thing. They froze the assets that were held in the United States of that country. And ultimately, they were able to freeze about $8 billion that way. Not all of it connected to Germany, but most of it. And if you think about that $8 billion, that's about, in today's money, that's about $150 billion. So obviously it didn't stop the atrocities of the Holocaust, but imagine what Hitler would have been able to do if he had access to those funds.
Right, right.
The story then goes on. During the war, the only way to get access into Nazi-occupied territory was by getting a license from the predecessor agency to OFAC, which was called the Office of Foreign Funds Control. It was in the Treasury Department, and it's the predecessor agency to the part of Treasury that I oversaw, among other things. So during the course of the war, different organizations came in to try to get a license to be allowed to get assets into those countries. And there's a lot of risk aversion, and repeatedly the answer was no. Until 1943, the World Jewish Congress goes to the Treasury Department to a man named John Paley, who was relatively young 30s, who was heading up that office. And they said, among other things, there are Jewish children in hiding in Nazi-occupied France, and we need to get assets in there in order to help them escape and ultimately survive. And it was that request that really motivated John Paley to say, okay, we got to help. We got to do something here. And it seems right to you and me probably like something of a no-brainer. But in order to actually effectuate the license, Treasury had to get approval from the State Department. And then there was a battle that ensued between the Treasury Department and the State Department over a period of months, with the State Department not wanting to be helpful. And Treasury started to get a bit suspicious of what was happening, what was going on at the State Department. And so over a weekend, they snuck into the State Department through a friend, and they ended up uncovering and getting access to a bunch of cables in which that had been sent to the State Department documenting effectively what was happening in Europe with the concentration camps, among other things. And of course, they were stunned. They go back to the Treasury Department and they write an 18-page memo to Secretary Morgenthau going through all of the different points in time where the State Department hid what was happening. And they titled the memo "Report to the Secretary on the Acquiescence of this Government in the Murder of the Jews." Mm. And Morgenthau, within a couple of days, this is now like around January 1944, within a couple of days, he takes that information, he takes it to President Roosevelt and said, "Mr. Roosevelt, you have to do something here. You have to help." And Roosevelt says yes, and he ultimately decided to stand up something called the War the War Refugee Board, which was run. He picked actually that John Paley, who was in his young 30s, from the Treasury Department to run the War Refugee Board. Not a typical Treasury, you know, mandate, but I think he understood that you could not now put that in the hands of the State Department, and they ended up saving tens of thousands, if not more, of Jews and others. who were, you know, victims in the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The remarkable part of that story for me was that at the very same time that those really courageous Treasury Department officials stood up to do the right thing, because they found out that there were Jewish children in hiding in Europe. My parents were Jewish children in hiding in Poland. So imagine sort of this incredible circle of life, right, where you've got a child of survivors now leading this program at the Treasury Department of that was previously, you know, employed the really courageous people at the Treasury Department who were working to help save Jewish children in hiding. It's
I have to tell you, I've heard you tell this story before, and I get goosebumps every time. It's really an amazing story. So, Segal, could you briefly walk us through your career? And if you can, let us know what motivated you and who motivated you along the way.
Well, what motivated me along the way fundamentally really was my family history. I went into the Justice Department shortly after 9/11. I had clerked on the Supreme Court during 9/11, which was quite an experience. And then I really wanted to do, when 9/11 hit, was to go and join the fight against Al-Qaeda and the fight to protect our national security. And so I was honored to be and humbled to be able to join the Justice Department in 2002. I went then to work for Michael Chertoff, who was head of the criminal division at the Justice Department. From there, and we mostly worked on national security. From there, Chris Wray, who's now the director of the FBI, was actually in the Deputy Attorney General's office, and he and Larry Thompson, who was then the Deputy Attorney General, recruited me to go up to the Deputy Attorney General's office to help fight the war on terror from the perspective of that office. I then went on to Manhattan to be a prosecutor in the Southern District of New York. During that time period, Mike Chertoff was nominated to be Secretary of Homeland Security, and he asked me to come back to be sort of part of his small office of people who were helping him manage the Department of Homeland Security. So I couldn't say no, and I did that. I was a counselor to the secretary, and then I went back to the Justice Department at that point after that to be a Deputy Assistant Attorney General, where, by the way, remarkably, Michael, I supervised a number of different sections, including OSI, which was the traditional Nazi hunting section. So my life kind of intersected. We helped really stand up an effort to have to go after all kinds of human rights violators. I also supervised the computer crime section, the child exploitation section. And then in 2009, I went into private practice. I ended up being a partner at a law firm, Proskauer, for 8 years. Wasn't planning on going back into the government. Out of the blue, in December 2016, I got a call asking if I would be willing to be considered to be the Undersecretary of the Treasury for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence. And it was actually a difficult decision for me because, as you know very, very well, there's a lot of sacrifice to public service that so many people in public service go through.
Right.
And ultimately, actually, it was a call that I had with one of my, I've been very fortunate to have a lot of mentors along the way. And this was a call that I had with Justice Thomas, who I had clerked for. And when I was asking him, should I do this? And
this is Clarence Thomas on the Supreme Court. Yeah.
And he said to me, well, what would your mother say? And my mom had passed away a number of years before. And I said, well, you know, she would have been proud. And he said, no, what would your mother say with what your family went through in World War II? He knew my family history, you know, how they survived the Holocaust, how so many people in your family actually didn't survive, because probably about, I would guess, 90, 95% of my family was killed. And what your parents then went through and struggled through ultimately to come to the United States, you know, and give you and your brother a better life and pursue the American dream. He said, I'm not telling you what to do, but what would she say? And so
I think he had you right there.
Pretty much. He later said, I didn't tell you what to do. And I said, oh, really? Because let's go through that. But he was right. You know, it was the ability to go back into public service to help, you know, our national security, to go after, bad actors all over the world, to go after human rights violators and corrupt actors, to really help areas like North Korea and Iran and Venezuela was really one of the greatest, you know, honors. And also to lead a remarkable career force that we had, that still we have at Treasury was of people who are just so extraordinarily dedicated. So it was a great honor.
So Segal, so you end up in this very senior job at the Treasury Department. You've already mentioned it, the Undersecretary of the Treasury for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence. I want to ask you two questions. What is an undersecretary? It's kind of a strange term, strange for most people. And what were your responsibilities in that job?
Sure. So an undersecretary, let's just say at the Treasury Department, there are plenty of undersecretaries all over the federal government. At the Treasury Department, it's one of the number three positions. So at Treasury, you have a Secretary of the Treasury, you have a deputy secretary. I actually was also acting deputy secretary through a big, good chunk of my tenure at Treasury. And then you have three undersecretaries who are leading and managing the different components of the department. The components that I had were OFAC, which is really sort of the heart of the U.S. sanctions program.
What does that stand for, OFAC?
It stands for Office of Foreign Assets Control, and it's just like all of my sections has an incredible role to play in the national security of our country. I also oversaw FinCEN. So FinCEN is the primary regulator in the United States for anti-money laundering, and they also do just remarkable work keeping our financial infrastructure in many, many different ways, safe from money laundering. I had a policy shop called TFFC that did a lot of work globally. All my components did, but they had a big focus on the global piece, and also a lot of work with the National Security Council, as did I. And then I had an intelligence agency that I oversaw. In fact, the interesting piece about that is that the U.S. Treasury Department, I believe, is the only finance ministry in the world that has its own intelligence agency. And as you know very, very well, that's a remark, you know, that's really an extraordinary tool for us to have within the Treasury Department to go after threat finance all over the world.
And that intelligence agency is actually part of the larger intelligence community, right?
Yes, that's exactly right. Yep. And so
I was going to ask, can you give us an example of an issue that you worked on during your time in that job?
Sure. So early on, actually, really the first week of my tenure at the Treasury Department, we were charged with really sort of keeping our country safe from the threat of North Korea's weapons, the developments around North Korea's weapons mass destruction program.
Right.
And so we had, and the thought was that the best way to do that was by using different levers of financial and economic pressure to keep them from having the ability to get access to the funds that they needed in order to continue to develop that program, and B, to put a tremendous amount of economic pressure on them to get them to change their behavior.
I guess I'd say C2, right, which is send a message to other countries who might think about going down the same road that here's what's going to happen to you.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that is exactly it. That if you engage in activity that threatens, you know, not only just the U.S. national security, but really globally, then you're going to find on the other side of that, you're going to really, really, you know, have a very difficult time gaining access to that money and a very difficult internal problems.
So when you do that, you're trying to find ways of shutting off their access to money.
It's shutting off not only their access to the U.S. financial system, but we have lots of tools to shut their access off from all kinds of other financial systems. And part of that is through what we call sanctions or another tool that we had called secondary sanctions. Part of that is identifying and disrupting the networks that we're trying to operate sort of under the radar to get funds and materials to North Korea. And we had a lot of really incredible cases, for example, or sanctions that we were able to bring targeting vast networks that were enabling, that had been working, which we helped cut off to make money, you know, in order to help to do commerce with North Korea and banks. We had a very heavy lever really on banks, which is the biggest tool that we have.
We're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsor, and we'll be right back with more of a discussion with Sigal Mandelker.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
So, Sigal, let's shift gears a little bit here, and let me ask you about ransomware attacks. Mm-hmm. So, as everybody knows by reading the paper and watching the news, they are growing in number, and they're growing in the amount of ransom that's being requested, and as you know, in many cases, paid. What I want to ask you is about the use of cryptocurrency as what seems to be the preferred method of payment for many of these attackers. And I want to ask you that from the perspective of someone, you know, who's worked in overseeing stopping illegal money transfers from actually happening, and somebody who's interested in financial innovation. How you think about that?
Sure. Well, I think a couple things that we have to recognize with ransomware. Number one, the best way to protect our country from ransomware is to do what, you know, I know the Biden administration and the private sector are very focused on, which is to enhance our cybersecurity, right? There are, the only reason ransomware hackers are able to successfully put these companies and entities at, you know, sort of hostage in a sense, is because there are vulnerabilities that have given them an in. The other piece I think is really important to understand, as somebody who spent much of my career going after a wide range of bad actors or actors who are trying to get access to money to do bad things, right, is that for the most part, those actors are technology neutral, right? They just want to find the best possible way to be able to get the funding that they need. And so whether that's through trade-based money laundering, whether that's through shell companies at traditional financial institutions, whether that's through whole wallets or cash couriers, or through cryptocurrency, they're going to tend to be motivated to go for the thing that they think is going to get them the best ability to get them the money that they are looking for. And while, you know, there's no question, and we worked on this when I was at Treasury, that crypto has become a mechanism of choice for ransomware, I think that what a lot of these attackers are starting to appreciate and to realize is that when they use try to use Bitcoin, for example, this is something that you've written on, Michael, when they try to use something like Bitcoin to get access to funding, they find that, when they use Bitcoin, it all travels on a public ledger. It's very traceable. It's immutable. And effectively, because it's a public ledger, it's leading them. It's actually giving law enforcement an incredible tool to actually find them, identify them, disrupt them, seize their crypto, which is happening in increasing amount at very big numbers, and shut them down and arrest them. So we saw that, of course, recently in Colonial Pipeline. You saw that a great example of that was the Twitter hack that happened about a year ago, where hackers were able to get access to high profile Twitter accounts and put a Bitcoin address, say, hey, give me, you know, send money here and you'll get some benefit. Of course, because they used crypto, within 2 weeks, law enforcement was able to trace them down and arrest them, which is really extraordinary. So yes, crypto is used for ransomware. I think what we're seeing with increasingly sophisticated tools like blockchain analytic tools from companies like Chainalysis, by the way, which we're an advisor to and we're an investor in, is that those kinds of tools have really been fundamental to helping law enforcement go after bad activity. And when you drive bad activity, as we've also seen to great extent out of the ecosphere, you leave lots of room for super exciting, innovation that we're also seeing in that sector. And we have to understand that innovation, take advantage of it. I mean, there's a lot of really exciting stuff that's happening in this this space that I think warrants a lot of additional attention.
So great transition. As I mentioned in the introduction at the beginning of the podcast, you're now working in this financial technology space. And maybe for the rest of the podcast, we can talk about the importance of financial technology, the importance of financial innovation to national security. And maybe the place to start is to define the term financial technology, commonly referred to as fintech. What are people talking about when they use that term, Segal?
So they're really talking about using technology to deliver a wide variety of financial products that can bring often much greater efficiency, transparency, security, simplicity, consumer protection, and also things around AML and compliance, right? So it's the intersection between super interesting and exciting technology and financial services, and how the way I think about it is how we can use those two to bring a much wider spectrum of products to a much greater number of consumers who have been traditionally served in the financial ecosystem, whether that's lending, finance, personal finance, insurance, financial software, crypto. And the list really just goes on and on.
And so why did you decide to do this? Why did you decide to focus on this when you left government?
Yeah, so I decided to focus on this when I left government, because when I was at the Treasury Department, this was very much a global job, right? I was in 27 countries, many of them multiple times in 2.5 years. I met, spent time in the developing world and emerging markets. I met with lots of very senior government officials from those countries. And I also met with CEOs of banks in a lot of those countries. And repeatedly, particularly in those markets, I would have senior officials, CEOs of banks come to me and say, hey, you know, we're having problem getting access to U.S. correspondent banking. Can you help us? In that role, I can't tell a bank where to operate. It doesn't work that way. We work with those countries to try to get, you know, help enhance them from a compliance perspective. But it became increasingly clear to me, and the numbers really bear this out, that that the U.S. banking presence in those regions had really significantly decreased. And I think there are a lot of root causes for that, which we could talk about at length. But I came to the conclusion that the only way that we were going to change that picture was through financial technology companies who had a different operating model, who who had the ability and the flexibility to do to operate in other regions without having sort of massive legacy risk systems that were keeping them from doing so, while also, you know, having the ability to root out illicit activity, et cetera. So I just came to the conclusion that, you know, the U.S. was, this is a big problem for the U.S. and not a problem that I thought in those regions that our banks were going to be able to solve. Came to the conclusion that we really needed innovation to solve it. By the way, this is not just a global issue, right? There's a whole nother conversation we could have about people who are underserved today in our country.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
So, Segal, what are the links between fintech, financial technology, and national security?
So there are many, and I'll just focus on a couple. So one is this issue that I said, which is I fundamentally believe that if you don't have a U.S. presence, a financial presence in a number of different countries around the world, all those tools of economic leverage that I spoke about before, whether are going to be significantly diminished. I'll give you a great example of that. When I was in Uganda, I had somebody when I was at Treasury, I had somebody say to me, like, what do you do with these sanctions? You sanction people. They come out of the bush, they go back into the bush, right? And he was saying that because when you sanction people who have no connection whatsoever to the U.S. financial infrastructure, it really doesn't make any kind of a difference. So from a national security perspective, I think it's really important that you have a much, you know, that we change that dynamic. And I, again, fundamentally believe that financial technology companies can really help us get there. The other piece of it is what I was talking about with respect to ransomware. So I think, you know, again, if you look at companies that are in the blockchain analytics space, like Chainalysis, they have the ability to detect and help in the process of disrupting the movement of illicit, you know, illicit proceeds or illicit funding to bad actors. And it's really incredible what they're able to do today using blockchain technology and blockchain analytics, actually in a way that's fundamentally not as in some respects, that's not as viable when you're talking with about the traditional banking system. They have different methods to detect illicit activity, but crypto actually gives you, and blockchain analytic tools give you the opportunity to detect and disrupt national security threats in a way that I think is very, very important. So it's those two pieces, right, which is expanding presence of the U.S. It's thinking in a much more sophisticated way how you can use things also like blockchain to help deliver humanitarian aid in countries where our banking system doesn't currently allow for it, right? There's all kinds of really sophisticated and fascinating ways that you can use those technologies to counter corruption because of the nature of the technology, the auditability, the fact that you can program the money potentially such that if it does end up in the wrong hands, you could get it to revert back. I mean, there's just so many really interesting and exciting ways that fintech and crypto can, I believe, help enhance our national security and also help to bring a much greater number of people into the banking system than have access it today. So, there are about over a billion people who have a mobile phone today who don't have a bank account. Imagine the U.S., you know, through great U.S. companies, imagine enabling all of those people to get access to financial services. There are so many, I think, really exciting ways in which that can help from a humanitarian perspective, can help from a national security perspective, can help from an economic prosperity perspective.
So the Chinese seem to get what you just said, right? They seem to understand the implications of fintech. And as you know, they've been investing heavily in it. How has it paid off for them? And where are they on fintech compared to us?
Yeah, look, China has, I think, an unbelievable number of, you know, very smart and sophisticated engineers and product developers who fundamentally understand that nexus between mobile and financial services. So you look at a company like Alipay, which is a Chinese company. Alipay today has, and it's a mobile payments network, among other things. Alipay today has 1.3 billion users globally. They have more users than every other major fintech combined. So if you combine not just the US, but all of the major fintech players globally, you'll see that they are, let's say we estimated about a billion, give or take. That's less than what Alipay has. So
it's amazing.
So yeah, it's quite extraordinary. And of course, China also, in lots of different ways, but they are doing a lot of work to develop their own state-owned, state-controlled digital currency through something called the ECNY, where they've actually developed a digital yuan using a variety of different technologies, but with a blockchain component to it to digitize their currency. No other, with very few exceptions, with some small countries like the Bahamas, no other country, you know, very, very few countries are even close to where they are in the development of that technology.
And if they develop that technology and they're able to actually use it for trade, then that cuts them completely out of the U.S. sanction system, correct?
Yes, it certainly, not completely, but yes, I think in large extent it has the capability of doing so. And look, they've actually said, you know, that it's a priority for them to cut U.S., the U.S. monopolization of the U.S., what they call monopolization of financial infrastructure to expand the use of the yuan.
So you and I have talked about this, and you've heard me say that I think, and I think you agree with me, that when we talk about sort of the key technologies where we are competing with the Chinese, right, whether it's microelectronics or synthetic bio or AI or radio communications, 5G, that fintech really, really belongs on that list for all the reasons you just talked about.
Without a doubt. Look, I think that we really need to make it both a national security and economic security imperative priority to incentivize that kind of innovation out of the United States. I think that if we don't do that, then we could find ourselves in a very different place with a different global financial infrastructure in not too many years.
And what do we need to do to make sure that we get this right? What are the big moving parts here?
The biggest moving part is what I just said, which is we need to have a national strategy to incentivize that financial technology out of the United States. And I think it should be something that's really driven at the top of the government from the White House with the National Security Council and the National Economic Council. And I know there are lots of people, you know, who are really thinking about this problem. I think that strategy has to be driven down throughout the federal departments and agencies to implement it. I think if that doesn't happen, it's going to be very, very difficult for us to reverse these trends, because departments and agencies, you know, that do a ton of great work, but they also tend to kind of, they can sometimes operate without infusing like those kinds of principles that make up that sort of the bigger picture, right? So you want the banking regulators, for example, to understand that when they take certain actions, to really assess what that's going to do to find it, for how that's going to actually enhance financial inclusion, how that's actually going to enhance the ability of U.S. companies to operate all over the world. And if they don't do that, if they don't sort of play this out, I think on the enforcement side, you know, across the board, I think we may not get the incentives right. That doesn't mean you don't hold entities accountable to complying with their regulatory obligations. Of course, that's very important, but you have to do it in such a way that you advance the ball for financial inclusion, that you advance the national security, very important national security implications of a continued diminishment of that U.S. Presence globally.
Sigal, thank you so much for a great conversation, and thank you so much for joining us. And it sounds to me like what you're doing today is just as important as what you did in the many jobs you had in the U.S. government. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That was Sigal Mandelker. I'm Michael Morrell. Please join us next week for another episode of Intelligence Matters.
Intelligence Matters is sponsored by Lockheed Martin. Your mission is ours. This show is produced by Olivia Gassis, Jamie Benson, Jake Rosen, Paulina Smolinski, and Ashley Armstrong. For more from this week's show, visit cbsnews.com. Intelligence Matters is a production of CBS Audio.
Catch every episode of 60 Minutes, America's most watched news magazine show, as a podcast. Hear in-depth investigations across politics, news, and entertainment on your schedule. Listen to 60 Minutes ad-free on Wondery Plus.